Hello and welcome to episode 20 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, this time featuring Steve Marshall, Secretary and Registrar at the University of the Arts London, with me talking about lots of topical higher education matters. Steve talks us briefly through his career and how he ended up at UAR before we explore the nature of the role of Secretary and Registrar and their equivalents within universities, considering whether such roles are indeed the last postings for the gifted amateur, or perhaps more realistically a destination for those with real breadth of experience and knowledge within universities. The jury is clearly still out on that one. The pandemic is, of course, central to our discussion, and we learn about UAL's response to lockdown and all of the preparations which have been undertaken for such an eventuality, although no one, of course, expected it to be quite so dramatic. Nevertheless, the university had responded well, including to the particular challenges faced by art and design students. UAL also determined early on to start the 2021 session later in October, which is a decision Steve feels is a particularly helpful one, looking around at other institutions' experiences. We also talk about all of the stuff around the future working model for university professional services, as well as the experience, largely a mixed one, of online meetings of one kind or another. Finally, drawing on the UAL experience, we explore the likelihood of future mergers in the sector, and note that these things generally take time, investment and commitment. I do hope you enjoy it. Welcome, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be back here with University Registrars talking about stuff. And this time, it's my great pleasure to introduce Steve Marshall of the University of the Arts London. Steve, welcome. Thank you. Good to see you.
And you.
Right. And as an introduction to you and to your institution, it'd be really great to hear actually how you ended up in your current position. And I can't remember what your title, are you COO? You're a COO?
No, Secretary and Registrar.
Oh, brilliant, old school, they're the best. So how did you end up as Secretary and Registrar at the University of the Arts London then?
Well, I obviously won't give you a summary of 30 years working in the sector, that would be tedious beyond belief. I call myself the accidental administrator really, because I started out, as many of us probably did in the sector back in the day, by an accident really. A sort of a temporary graduate job led to a permanent graduate job, led to some interest in the sector, application to a permanent role. So yeah, that's how I started in the sector. And I've worked my way through five universities, and I'm now currently at University of the Arts London. I'm very happy as well. I've worked in most of the student-facing services of universities. I've worked in research departments. I've worked in finance departments. And I've majored really in registry services. That's where I spent most of my career. So now I'm the Secretary Registrar at University of the Arts London, which, as you will know, spans the corporate governance, health and safety, company secretary, through to most of the student-facing services of the institution. And we're slightly different at UAL because we do also have a significant amount of further education. I'm responsible for the FE provision of the university, so that's an added dimension to the role. You know, I love it, of course. Most of us do. It's endlessly fascinating. You work with great people, but it's not a planned career. So I think I describe myself probably, and my generation, which upsets a lot of people. You know, we are the sort of the last bastions for the gifted amateur, really. I think there's a whole new generation of professionals coming through who probably choose to work in HE.
So I know what you mean about the gifted amateur thing, but the reality is you don't get to your position without having some professionalism and skill. And I suppose the way I would see it is that not so much amateurism as breadth rather than depth. And yes, people do get to our kind of positions having particular expertise, but it sounds like you've had real breadth across the whole range of university administration, which I think you're right, isn't as common as it used to be. But don't you think it's kind of coming back into fashion, in the sense that in order to survive in a world which is incredibly fast moving and changing, actually having that broad understanding of the way that universities work is a kind of real advantage when you're in the kind of secretary, registrar, COO type role.
I think it is, and you're quite right to pick me up on that. I mean, I'm in danger of being slightly flippant about the gifted amateur, and it wasn't, I wasn't using that as a sort of insult, really. It was about about breadth rather than specialism, I think. But I think you're right. I mean, if you'd asked me that 5 years ago, I would have said, I think we are the last generation. But it, actually, in truth, I think to do the job that we do successfully, I do think you need an deep understanding of every element of a university business, frankly. And I think that's what we've got.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree with you on that. And then if you think about the situation that we faced over the last 6 months, I mean, you know, in your time in your roles, you will have experienced, you know, kind of crises and incidents of one kind or another, you know, which, you know, you kind of go through periodically, and then you have the scenario exercises and all the rest of it. But actually, sometimes you have lots of real events where you have to, you know, you have to respond very quickly and bring teams of people, ensure the institution's, you know, responding to the challenges it faces. I mean, this is the biggest kind of, incident, crisis, anything any of us ever faced. But did you feel kind of better, or did you feel prepared for it when it struck back in March?
I don't think I can honestly say we felt prepared, other than we practiced meeting, you know, as a sort of crisis team for a number of years, as all universities do now. Yeah. So there's nothing, we're not any different to anybody else. I think the difference is we were quite smug before. You know, we had a great risk register, we have a great disaster recovery plan, business continuity plan, we had rehearsals regularly. You know, we might even have two or three crises at the same time. Well, now you've got a crisis which affects every element of the university. So in a sense, it has been like having an icy cold shower, and it's a bit of a wake-up call. But actually, I think we've managed as best we can. I think we've been pretty good overall. We have, thank goodness, worked in that sort of space for a while, as all universities have. We have practiced it. It's just that we never thought it would be anything like as significant as this. I mean, we did have avian flu, of course, about 12 years ago.
SARS.
But, you know, that was really contained. It didn't affect us. It was all very theoretical. It was a typical British, you know, sort of, well, if it arrives here, if it's sort of, they bring it here. But of course, you know, this is all of us. It's truly global, isn't it?
Absolutely. So you weren't unprepared for it. I mean, no. I agree with you in terms of, you know, the way it felt. But the scale was just kind of, you know, completely unfamiliar, in the sense, you know, it was bigger than anything we've seen before. But how did your university reacted well to this, do you think? And I mean, did you kind of slip into it, or has it felt like it was actually adapting to a completely new way of working? I mean, did people feel, you know, immediately comfortable with the adapting to the new requirements of this strange new world?
I don't think you can generalize across all staff groups. I mean, I think the leadership team, I think that the management layer, I think senior academics, I have to say, I think adapted remarkably well and very quickly indeed. So I think we were confident from the outset that we had the right structures in place. I think the concern has always been large numbers of staff and staff groups who are not involved in the day-to-day decision-making and crisis management, who, you know, you need to make an extra special effort to keep on board. So that's been the challenge, I think. And, you know, you'd expect that in any large university. But I suppose we started from day one. I mean, I think we all knew at UAL that this was going to be a huge crisis, and we weren't going to sort of slip into gradually getting used to working this way. We sort of, I suppose, we did scenario plan from day one. We didn't catastrophize, but we did expect the worst and we planned for the worst. I know a number of my contemporaries and peers in the sector are the same. I'm sure you are. You know, from day one, that first gold meeting, you know, we thought, actually, we're talking possibly about closure. Yeah, we're talking about a year of no revenue, potentially.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what we were planning for, and we worked back from that point.
I mean, that is really interesting, Steve, because I think that there are parts of the sector who expected that somehow there would be a really generous support package from government, and that one way or another, any shortfall in income would somehow be made up by a benign, progressive, forward-looking administration, which would see how much value universities added to the economy. But actually, it's not been like that. I mean, the level of support has been pretty small beer, really. You know, it's not amounted to much more than a front-loading of payments and potential for a loan package on the research side, which we're yet to actually see the full details of. So there isn't an awful lot there. So it's, the future is very much in our own hands. And it's time when you've got this real uncertainty, particularly about student recruitment. I mean, it has been, the most chaotic confirmation and clearing round I've ever seen. The uncertainty about international student recruitment, the whole thing feels incredibly challenging. So if you're not kind of incredibly cautious and conservative about your financial future, then there is a danger. You are, digging a hole for yourself, really.
I think so. And I think, you'd be living in a fool's paradise if you thought there was going to be helpful government handouts. I mean, we never thought there ever would be. I mean, to be fair, we have used the furlough scheme, and that is deeply helpful. But, so is everybody else. But no, I mean, we don't think there's anything to change the tone and approach from government towards the sector at all from COVID onwards. And we didn't expect that from the beginning. So we thought, actually, we're on our own here. We've got to look at what we're prepared to lose, what we're prepared to cut back on, and what we're prepared to save. And I think that's the approach we've taken actually from the beginning.
So how did you get, I mean, so you put in place a kind of savings kind of, package then, or, kind of refund. Well, I don't know how you approached it. I'd be interested to hear you did approach it, but also how you got people on board with that, because actually that's quite a difficult sell when others aren't necessarily all going down the same road.
I mean, it is. And we are very fortunate compared to a number of our friends in the sector, to be perfectly blunt about it. So demand for the institution and our student numbers has been healthy for a number of years. Our balance sheet's good. We have sufficient cash to be able to operate for months, many months now. That's not to say, of course, we don't still consider ourselves to be in crisis. We do. But we've had gentle cost cutting. We've had voluntary severance scheme, which has been very successful. So we're approaching it in that way. But of course, we're prepared for this, depending on what happens in the next 3 weeks with enrollment. We are prepared, of course, for the drastic action we will have to take if necessary. But for the moment, we are, compared to some of our friends, in the sector, as I say, I do not envy some institutions at all. I mean, they are, that if they have issues with student recruitment in the first place, then my God, they've got them now. It's terribly difficult.
Yeah. And thinking about how this has affected particularly kind of an institution like yours. I mean, it's the thing about the arts is the face-to-face stuff, right, is really important, it seems to me, and that must have been a really big issue for your institution.
It's the biggest issue, and we're still facing that as our biggest challenge. I mean, I think all universities thrive on being present, and being on campus, and that sense of community. Art and design, of course, is that and some. So trying to persuade a graphic designer or a fine arts student that their entire learning is online is not easy. Now, for a short term, the university community accepted that. Students were very understanding of that. Longer term, is how sustainable is that? It's very difficult. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we run text-only courses as well. So many of our courses are fairly straightforward to pivot onto an online learning experience. But it was hugely difficult. And of course, we thrive on workshops and studios, and of course, all the contingent problems around that with a blended learning model and social distancing is enormous. So yes, it's been exceptionally difficult, and it must be, of course, for any laboratory-based subjects as well. It's not just art and design, naturally. It's anything that there's space needed, and where there's physical interaction needed, and you know, physical experiments or producing of work. Massive difficulty for us, and that is our biggest single worry for the next few months, is how we can sustain that.
So you've had to adapt to that very different environment in terms of, you know, limiting or indeed not having face-to-face. And how have students coped with that? I mean, have they responded creatively to the challenges that they've been faced with?
Massively. So many students have produced the best work they've ever produced.
Right.
Their interaction with their fellow students has never been better. Many students, particular groups of students, have thrived on the online Teams experience because they are the students who are very reticent to come forward in a studio, workshop or lecture setting, interestingly. Other students, of course, resent it and find it extremely difficult and isolating, and their creativity is compromised because of that style. Yeah. And many students want their money back. So we've got challenges coming forward, of course. Yeah. With, you know, what does a refund look like now? On what basis should we give a refund? So there's some very hard-nosed issues we've got to deal with as well, I'm afraid, about value for money and the contract between the university and the student.
But they will take some time to play out as well, because there's a long way to go in that kind of dispute territory. And well, we all look forward to seeing how you get on.
Well, thank you very much. But I mean, you know, the first registrar that agrees to give wholesale refunds will not be popular, I can tell you.
No, I agree. And it's one of it's one of those things where you're also looking to government for a steer, and they reinforce the autonomy of institutions.
I mean, I think one of our jobs, and my job, is to sort of get some perspective on this in the institution. Clearly, we have a higher number of student inquiries and complaints or concerns, I should say, being raised. So, you know, we have at any one time, you know, 400 cases ongoing related to COVID. But you have to step back a little. We have 20,000 students. If you have our short course students as well, that's 40,000. So in terms of the scale, we got to remember that it's the minority, actually, that will take it the nth degree, I think. Most of our students so far understand and are prepared to be flexible.
And I believe that University Arts London has decided to open to start its new session slightly later than it would have otherwise done so. Do you want to talk us through that?
Well, yes, we took that decision from almost from the beginning, actually, that we would delay our term by at least a month. And we did that because we knew that we have nearly 50% of our students are international EU.
Right.
So post-Brexit, we'll have 50% of our students will be international. And obviously, you know, predicting the behaviour of that constituent of students is so difficult. And we knew that the whole visa issue was unresolved at the time, of course, at the beginning of lockdown. And we knew that international flights were likely to be highly disrupted. There's likely to be lockdown. So we felt that our term, you know, to give us, if you like, more of a chance to phase enrollment more than we normally would be more helpful. And we also invited our graduated students from last July, this July gone, to come back to campus to use the facilities they would have otherwise have used, even though they've graduated under a blended learning model. So we felt, you know, we were almost honour bound, really, because they had no experience in the final term of in the workshop. So we felt that we wanted to invite them back. So we wanted to phase all of that. So hence, we put back the start of term. But thank goodness we did, because we can observe other institutions much earlier enrolment and learn, perhaps, and share some of their experiences.
Yeah. And the country is, you know, facing a very challenging time as we speak now, and we'll see how that pans out. If we can go back then to the kind of the last 6 months and how it's panned out within the university. I mean, we talked about the impact on academic staff and on students. What about your colleagues in, you know, in professional services? How have they responded to this, you know, this remote working environment? And, you know, particularly those of them who are, you know, student facing, but also those who were, you know, we're very much used to, you know, face-to-face contact.
Well, it's been very difficult, you know, and I don't want to appear smug. You know, we've had our problems, we've made our mistakes, you know, and we haven't always got it right with different staff groups. But actually, you know, the professional staff have responded extremely well and adapted very readily, actually, to the endless use of Teams. And, you know, particularly our finance, our HR staff, our registry services staff have, I wouldn't say it's business as usual, because of course we all thrive on the university community and being on campus, but actually their jobs lend themselves quite readily to that type of working, and I think the feedback in general has been very positive, although the honeymoon period is over, and I think we now have a real fatigue setting in, and a sense of isolation from quite unexpected places and people. So often the most resilient, confident, adaptable, flexible people are the people at the moment who are suffering and really do want to come back to site.
And I see lots of that as well. And what we're trying to do, and I'm sure you are as well, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is trying to kind of reconceptualize what the professional services delivery model of the future looks like, bearing in mind we've seen the traditional model, the extreme of this entire remote working model, but you've got to imagine that there's somewhere in between the two, which is in fact going to be the new delivery model for the future. I wonder what your thoughts are about the way things will go there.
It will undoubtedly change for our part of the university business, definitely. Although I'm sort of having a very civilised but active discussion with our Director of Estates about an assumption that because we're working so well remotely, we will no longer need three floors of our King's Cross building or High Holborn or, you know, some of the more expensive real estate in London, which to an extent, to be fair, is true. And I think actually, you know, I think we could be looking at half our professional staff being able to work predominantly from home in the future. So we're modelling that now. Obviously, we're keeping frontline services on campus, naturally, obviously student services. Yeah. But no, we are going to be looking at least half of our staff, and which will, of course, have added benefits to the estate that we can turn over more buildings to teaching and research. But I draw the line at 100%. I'm working for 100% of the professional staff.
Yeah, but I do think it, I think it is really interesting, because I think it will create, you know, new approaches to working, which will see that much more kind of, you know, blended model where you get some remote working, some face-to-face working. And actually, you know, that's probably what loads of other industries have already experienced, particularly those with operations in London.
I think so. But there is a note of caution here, actually, about the way we work remotely. I think it is successful for professional services. It's also very efficient. We've observed that meetings are more organised, more orderly. People behave better. There's less interruption. But the downside is people behave more orderly. There are less interruptions. And I think we're getting quite into vanilla territory here, where you know, that's not a significant challenge, and the dynamic of a lot of groups is missing. Yeah. So we're doing some work now on looking at where we think the highest risks are in terms of remote working, and where there isn't sufficient challenge around the virtual table.
You know, you're trading the, you know, that for the efficiency, so you're going to get through it quicker. Yes. But all the rich stuff is kind of missing, and it's much harder to kind of generate a kind of you know, sense of interest and excitement, or indeed trajectory or narrative, than in a, you know, a face to face meeting. And I think that kind of richness is lost. Mm. So finding some way to combine the efficiency with the, you know, the lovely, you know, kind of reality and fleshy mess of a meeting is the real trick, I think. We'll see if we get. I look forward to hearing the outcome of your your investigation, Steve. One further thing I just want to explore while we can is kind of looking then into the future. So we talked about what professional services. What about our sector? I mean, you know, we talked about the way that different universities have approached the challenge. What do you think the future of our sector is? I mean, will we have wholesale mergers or university closures, or is it, you know, is it all just, you know, talk like it has been many times before?
Well, the feeling UAL, when we're discussing this, is we don't feel there'll be wholesale closures. We do feel that there could be mergers. Every university is in a constituency. Every closure will be controversial. So we don't think there'll be wholesale closures, although, you know, technically, I guess some universities are nearly insolvent or potentially could be. I mean, I think that's a real concern. We think possibly mergers. But for the future of the sector, I mean, you know, looking at London, there are, you know, the old discussion about too many, there's too much supply, there's too many universities.
Yeah,
I think that's true. I think there could be some very interesting discussions about close collaboration, if not merger. But for the future of the sector in the broadest sense, I don't think the pandemic is going to change campus life forever. I think there will be more online experiences. I think certainly services will be delivered online, as we've already said. But actually, given the majority of university students are 18, 19, 20-year-olds, most 18, 19, or 20-year-olds want to leave home. They want to live somewhere independently, and they want a sort of interaction with their peer group, you know, in a campus, a real live environment. I don't think we're looking at a new generation of online students. I think there's always going to be a campus in the sector. There's always going to be physical campuses. But I do think, yes, I do think there are going to be some brutal decisions made about mergers, very possibly.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I think people do overstate the merger impetus. It is difficult to do a merger, it well, and it's even harder to do it without a large sum of money to ease the transition as well. And also mergers, the consequences of them are felt by the new organisation for a very long time. And it takes a long time for that kind of genuine alignment of staff to be all pulling in the same direction within an institution, it seems to me. And you just need to look at institutions that are the product of mergers to see the fault lines that still remain in there. It takes a generation to change those, or a very large sum of money.
I think both. I think probably more than a generation. I mean, look at my own experience at UAL. I mean, UAL is six independent colleges. You know, I've often said in the past, you know, we achieved university status in 2004, and I think we became a university within the last 5 years.
That's a great slogan on which to finish. Steve, that's been an absolutely delightful conversation. It's been really good to talk to you about your university and your history, and also about the future of our sector and our profession. So thank you very much indeed for your time.
Well, thank you, Paul. It's been very enjoyable.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.